To help him, all I could do was conspire with another geisha to slow the pace of the game. The chairman seemed grateful for this, and when it was all over, he sat and talked with me a long while, drinking glasses of water to sober up. Finally, he took a handkerchief from his pocket, identical to the one tucked inside my obi, and wiped his forehead with it, and then smoothed his coarse hair back along his head before saying to me, "When was the last time you spoke with your old friend Nobu?" "Not in quite some time, Chairman," I said. "To tell the truth, I have the impression Nobu-san may be angry with me." The chairman was looking down into his handkerchief as he refolded it. "Friendship is a precious thing, Sayuri," he said. "One mustn't throw it away." I thought about this conversation often over the weeks that followed. Then one day late in April, I was putting on my makeup for a performance of Dances of the Old Capital, when a young apprentice I hardly knew came to speak with me. I put down my makeup brush, expecting her to ask a favor, because our Okia was still well supplied with things others in Gion had learned to do without. But instead she said, "I'm terribly sorry to trouble you, Sayuri-san, but my name is Takazuru. I wondered if you would mind helping me. I know you were once very good friends with Nobu-san." After months and months of wondering about him, and feeling terribly ashamed for what I'd done, just to hear Nobu's name when I didn't expect it was like opening storm shutters and feeling the first draft of air. "We must all help each other whenever we can, Takazuru," I said. "And if it's a problem with Nobu-san, I'm especially interested. I hope he's well." "Yes, he is well, ma'am, or at least I think so. He comes to the Awazumi Tea House in East Gion. Do you know it?" "Oh, yes, I know it," I said, "but I had no idea Nobu-san visited there." "Yes, ma'am, quite often," Takazuru told me. "But may I ask, Sayuri-san, you've known him a long while, and, well, Nobu-san is a kind man, isn't he?" "Takazuru-san, why do you ask me? If you've been spending time with him, surely you know whether or not he is kind." "I'm sure I must sound foolish, but I'm so confused. He asks for me every time he comes to Gion, and my older sister tells me he's as good a patron as any girl could hope for. But now she's angry with me because I've cried in front of him several times. I know I shouldn't do it, but I can't even promise I won't do it again." "He is being cruel to you, is he?" By way of answering, poor Takazuru clenched her trembling lips together, and in a moment tears began to pool at the edges of her lids, so much that her little round eyes seemed to gaze up at me from two puddles. "Sometimes Nobu-san doesn't know how harsh he sounds," I told her, "but he must like you, Takazuru-san. Otherwise, why would he ask for you?" "I think he asks for me only because I'm someone to be mean to," she said. "One time he did say my hair smelled clean, but then he told me what a nice change that was." "It's strange that you see him so often," I said. "I've been hoping for months to run into him."
"Oh, please don't, Sayuri-san. He already says how nothing about me is as good as you. If he sees you again, he'll only think the worse of me. I know I shouldn't bother you with my problems, ma'am, but I thought you might know something I could do to please him. He likes stimulating conversation, but I never know what to say. Everyone tells me I'm not a very bright girl."
People in Kyoto are trained to say things like this, but it struck me that this poor girl might be telling the truth. It wouldn't have surprised me if Nobu regarded her as nothing more than the tree where the tiger might sharpen its claws. I couldn't think of anything helpful, so in the end I suggested she read a book about some historical event Nobu might find interesting, and tell the story to him bit by bit when they met. I myself had done this sort of thing from time to time, for there were men who liked nothing more than to sit back with their eyes watery and half-closed and listen to the sound of a woman's voice. I wasn't sure it would work with Nobu, but Takazuru seemed very grateful for the idea. Now that I knew where to find Nobu, I was determined to go and see him. I felt terribly sorry I'd made him angry with me, and of course, I might never see the chairman again without him. I certainly didn't want to cause Nobu pain, but I thought perhaps by meeting with him I could find some way of resuming our friendship. The trouble was, I couldn't drop in uninvited at the Awazumi, for I had no formal relationship with the tea house. So in the end I made up my mind to to stroll past during the evening whenever I could, in the hopes of bumping into Nobu on his way there. I knew his habits well enough to make a fair guess about the time he might arrive. For 8 or 9 weeks I kept up this plan. Then at last, one evening, I spotted him emerging from the back of a limousine in the dark alleyway ahead of me. I knew it was him because the empty sleeve of his jacket, pinned at the shoulder, gave him an unmistakable silhouette. The driver was handing him his briefcase as I neared. I stopped in the light of a lantern there in the alley and let out a little gasp that would sound like delight. Nobu looked in my direction just as I'd hoped. "Well, well," he said, "one forgets how lovely a geisha can look." He spoke in such a casual tone I had to wonder whether he knew it was me. "Why, sir, you sound like my old friend Nobu-san," I said, "but you can't be him, for I have the impression he has disappeared completely from Gion." The driver closed the door, and we stood in silence until the car pulled away. "I'm so relieved," I said, "to see Nobu-san again at last, and what luck for me that he should be standing in the shadows rather than in the light."
"Sometimes I don't have the least idea what you're talking about, Sayuri. You must have learned this from Ameha, or maybe they teach it to all geisha."
"With Nobu-san standing in the shadows, I'm unable to see the angry expression on his face."
"I see," he said. "So you think I'm angry with you?"
"What else am I to think when an old friend disappears for so many months? I suppose you're going to tell me that you've been too busy to come to the Ichiriki."
"Why do you say it as if it couldn't possibly be true?"
"Because I happen to know that you've been coming to Gion often. But don't bother to ask me how I know. I won't tell you unless you agree to come on a stroll with me."
"All right," said Nobu, "since it's a pleasant evening."
"Oh, Nobu-san, don't say that. I'd much rather you said, 'Since I've bumped into an old friend I haven't seen in so long, I can't think of anything I'd rather do than go on a stroll with her.'"
"I'll take a walk with you," he said. "You may think whatever you like about my reasons for doing it."
I gave a little bow of assent to this, and we set off together down the alley in the direction of Maruyama Park. "If Nobu-san wants me to believe he isn't angry," I said, "he should act friendlier, instead of like a panther who hasn't been fed for months. No wonder poor Takazuro is so terrified of you."
"So she's spoken to you, has she?" said Nobu. "Well, if she weren't such an infuriating girl..."
"If you don't like her, why do you ask for her every time you come to Gion?"
"I've never asked for her, not even once. It's her older sister who keeps pushing her at me. It's bad enough you've reminded me of her. Now you're going to take advantage of bumping into me tonight to try to shame me into liking her."
"Actually, Nobu-san, I didn't bump into you at all. I've been strolling down that alley for weeks, just for the purpose of finding you." This seemed to give Nobu something to think about, for we walked along in silence a few moments. Finally, he said,
"I shouldn't be surprised. You're as conniving a person as I know."
"Nobu-san, what else was I to do?" I said. "I thought you had disappeared completely. I might never have known where to find you if Takazuru hadn't come to me in tears to say how badly you've been treating her."
"Well, I have been hard on her, I suppose. But she isn't as clever as you, or as pretty for that matter. If you've been thinking I'm angry with you, you're quite right."
"May I ask what I have done to make an old friend so angry?" Here Nobu-san stopped and turned to me with a terribly sad look in his eyes. I felt a fondness welling up in me that I've known for very few men in my life. I was thinking how much I had missed him and how deeply I had wronged him. But though I'm ashamed to admit it, my feelings of fondness were tinged with pity.
"After a considerable amount of effort," he said, "I have discovered the identity of your Donna."
"If Nobu-san had asked me, I would have been glad to tell him."
"I don't believe you. You geisha are the most closed-mouthed group of people. I asked around Gion about your Donna, and one after another they all pretended not to know. I never would have found out if I hadn't asked Michizono to come entertain me one night, just the two of us."
Michizono, who was about 50 at the time, was a sort of legend in Gion. She wasn't a beautiful woman, but she could sometimes put even Nobu in a good mood just by the way she crinkled her nose at him when she bowed hello.
"I made her play drinking games with me," he went on, "and I won and won until poor Michizono was quite drunk. I could have asked her anything at all, and she would have told me.
"What a lot of work," I said.
"Nonsense. She was very enjoyable company. There was nothing like work about it. But shall I tell you something? I have lost respect for you, now that I know your Donna is a little man in uniform who no one admires."
"Nobu-san speaks as if I have any choice over who my Donna is. The only choice I can make is what kimono I'll wear, and even then..."
"Do you know why that man has a desk job? It's because no one trusts him with anything that matters. I understand the army very well, Sayuri. Even his own superiors have no use for him. You may as well have made an alliance with a beggar. Really, I was once very fond of you, but..."
"Once? Is Nobu-san not fond of me any longer?"
"I have no fondness for fools."
"What a cold thing to say! Are you only trying to make me cry? Oh, Nobu-san, am I a fool because my Donna is a man you can't admire?"
"You geisha, there was never a more irritating group of people. You go around consulting your almanac, saying, 'Oh, I can't walk toward the east today because my horoscope says it's unlucky.' But then, when it's a matter of something affecting your entire lives, you simply look the other way."
"It's less a matter of looking the other way than of closing our eyes to what we can't stop from happening."
"Is that so? Well, I learned a few things from my talk with Michizono that night when I got her drunk. You are the daughter of the Okiya, Sayuri. You can't pretend you have no influence at all. It's your duty to use what influence you have, unless you want to drift through life like a fish belly up on the stream."
"I wish I could believe life really is something more than a stream that carries us along, belly up."
"All right, if it's a stream, you're still free to be in this part of it or that part, aren't you? The water will divide again and again.
If you bump and tussle and fight, you make use of whatever advantages you might have."
"Oh, that's fine, I'm sure, when we have advantages."
"You'd find them everywhere if you ever bothered to look. In my case, even when I have nothing more than, I don't know, a chewed-up peach pit or something of the sort, I won't let it go to waste. When it's time to throw it out, I'll make good and certain to throw it at somebody I don't like."
"Nobu-san, are you counseling me to throw peach pits?"
"Don't joke about it. You know perfectly well what I'm saying. We're very much alike, Sayuri. I know they call me Mr. Lizard and all of that, and here you are, the loveliest creature in Gion. But that very first time I saw you at the sumo tournament years ago, what were you, 14? I could see what a resourceful girl you were even then."
"I've always believed that Nobu-san thinks me more worthy than I really am."
"Perhaps you're right. I thought you had something more to you, Sayuri. But it turns out you don't even understand where your destiny lies. To tie your fortunes to a man like the general. I would have taken proper care of you, you know. It makes me so furious to think about it. When this general is gone from your life, he'll leave nothing for you to remember him by. Is this how you intend to waste your youth? A woman who acts like a fool is a fool, wouldn't you say?"
"If we rub a fabric too often, it will quickly grow threadbare." And Nobu's words had rasped against me so much I could no longer maintain that finely lacquered surface Mameha had always counseled me to hide behind. I felt lucky to be standing in shadow, for I was certain Nobu would think still less of me if he saw the pain I was feeling. But I suppose my silence must have betrayed me, for with his one hand he took my shoulder and turned me just a fraction until the light fell on my face, and when he looked me in the eyes, he let out a long sigh that sounded at first like disappointment.
"Why do you seem so much older to me, Sayuri?" he said after a moment. "Sometimes I forget you're still a girl. Now you're going to tell me I've been too harsh with you."
"I cannot expect that Nobu-san should act like anyone but Nobu-san," I said.
"I react very badly to disappointment, Sayuri. You ought to know that. Whether you failed me because you're too young or because you aren't the woman I thought, either way you failed me, didn't you?"
"Please, Nobu-san, it frightens me to hear you say these things. I don't know if I can ever live my life by the standards you use for judging me."
"What standards are those, really? I expect you to go through life with your eyes open. If you keep your destiny in mind, every moment in life becomes an opportunity for moving closer to it. I wouldn't expect this sort of awareness from a foolish girl like Takazuru, but..."
Hasn't Nobu-san been calling me foolish all evening?
You know better than to listen to me when I'm angry.
So Nobu-san isn't angry any longer. Then will he come see me at the Ichiriki Tea House? Or invite me to come and see him? In fact, I'm in no particular hurry this evening. I could come in even now, if Nobu-san asked me to.
By now we had walked around the block, and were standing at the entrance to the tea house. I won't ask you, he said, and rolled open the door.
I couldn't help but let out a great sigh when I heard this, and I call it a great sigh because it contained many smaller sighs within it. One sigh of disappointment, one of frustration, one of sadness, and I don't know what else.
Oh, Nobu-san, I said, sometimes you're so difficult for me to understand.
I'm a very easy man to understand, Sayuri, he said. I don't like things held up before me that I cannot have.
Before I had a chance to reply, he stepped into the tea house and rolled the door shut behind him. Chapter 27. During the summer of that year, 1939, I was so busy with engagements, occasional meetings with the general, dance performances, and the like, that in the morning, when I tried to get up from my futon, I often felt like a bucket filled with nails. Usually, by mid-afternoon, I managed to forget my fatigue, but I often wondered how much I was earning through all my efforts. I never really expected to find out, however, so I was quite taken aback when Mother called me into her room one afternoon and told me I'd earned more in the past 6 months than both Hatsumomo and Pumpkin combined.
Which means, she said, that it's time for you to exchange rooms with them.
I wasn't as pleased to hear this as you might imagine. Hatsumomo and I had managed to live side by side these past few years by keeping away from each other, but I regarded her as a sleeping tiger, not a defeated one. Hatsumomo certainly wasn't going to think of Mother's plan as exchanging rooms. She was going to feel that her room had been taken away from her. When I saw Mameha that evening, I told her what Mother had said to me and mentioned my fears that the fire inside Hatsumomo might flare up again.
"Oh, well, that's fine," said Mameha. "That woman won't be beaten once and for all until we see blood, and we haven't seen it yet. Let's give her a bit of a chance and see what sort of mess she makes for herself this time."
Early the next morning, Auntie came upstairs in the Okia to lay down the rules for moving our belongings. She began by taking me into Hatsumomo's room and announcing that a certain corner now belonged to me. I could put anything I wanted there, and no one else could touch it. Then she brought Hatsumomo and Pumpkin into my smaller room and set up a similar space for the two of them. After we'd swapped all our belongings, the move would be complete. I set to work that very afternoon carrying my things through the hall. I wish I could say I'd accumulated a collection of beautiful objects, as Mameha probably had by my age, but the mood of the nation had changed greatly. Cosmetics and permanence had recently been banned as luxuries by the military government, though of course those of us in Gion, as playthings of the men in power, still did more or less as we pleased. Lavish gifts, however, were almost unheard of, so I'd accumulated nothing more over the years than a few scrolls, inkstones, and bowls, as well as a collection of stereoscopic photos of famous views, with a lovely viewer made of sterling silver, which the kabuki actor Anoue Yoeguro XVII had given me. In any case, I carried these things across the hall, along with my makeup, undergarments, books, and magazines, and piled them in the corner of the room. But as late as the following evening, Hatsumomo and Pumpkin still hadn't begun moving their things out. On the way back from my lessons at noon on the third day, I made up my mind that if Hatsumomo's bottles and ointments were still crowded together on the makeup stand, I would go ask Auntie to help me. When I reached the top of the stairs, I was surprised to see both Hatsumomo's door and mine standing open. A jar of white ointment lay broken on the hallway floor. Something seemed to be amiss, and when I stepped into my room, I saw what it was. Hatsumomo was sitting at my little table, sipping at what looked like a small glass of water, and reading a notebook that belonged to me. Geisha are expected to be discreet about the men they know, so you may be puzzled to hear that several years earlier, while still an apprentice,
I'd gone into a paper store one afternoon and bought a beautiful book of blank pages to begin keeping a diary about my life. I wasn't foolish enough to write down the sorts of things a geisha is never expected to reveal. I wrote only about my thoughts and feelings. When I had something to say about a particular man, I gave him a code name. So, for example, I referred to Nobu as Mr. Tsu, because he sometimes made a little scornful noise with his mouth that sounded like Tsu. And I referred to the chairman as Mr. Ha, because on one occasion he'd taken a deep breath and let it out slowly in a way that sounded like Ha. And I'd imagined him waking up beside me as he said it, so of course it made a strong impression on me, but I'd never thought for a moment that anyone would see the things I'd written. "Why, Sayuri, I'm so pleased to see you," Atsumomo said. "I've been waiting to tell you how much I'm enjoying your diary. Some of the entries are most interesting, and really your writing style is charming. I'm not much impressed with your calligraphy, but..." "Did you happen to notice the interesting thing I wrote on the front page?" "I don't think I did. Let's see. Private. Well, now there's an example of what I'm talking about with your calligraphy. Atsumomo, please put the book down on the table and leave my room." "Really? I'm shocked at you, Sayuri. I'm only trying to be helpful. Just listen for a moment and you'll see. For example, why did you choose to give Nobu Tashikazu the name Mr. Tsu? It doesn't suit him at all. I think you should have called him Mr. Blister, or maybe Mr. One Arm. Don't you agree? You can change it if you want, and you don't even have to give me any credit." "I don't know what you're talking about, Atsumomo. I haven't written anything about Nobu at all." Atsumomo sighed, as if to tell me what an inept liar I was, and then began paging through my journal. "If it isn't Nobu you are writing about, I want you to tell me the name of the man you're referring to here. Let's see. Ah, here it is. Sometimes I see Mr. Tsu's face blooming with anger when a geisha has been staring at him. But for my part, I can look at him as long as I want, and he seems to be pleased by it. I think his fondness for me grows from his feeling that I don't find the look of his skin and his missing arm as strange and frightening as so many girls do. So I guess what you're telling me is that you know someone else who looks just like Nobu. I think you should introduce them. Think how much they'll have in common." By this time, I was feeling sick at heart. I can't think of any better way of describing it. For it's one thing to find your secret suddenly exposed, but when your own foolishness has exposed them, well, if I was prepared to curse anyone, it was myself, for keeping the journal in the first place and stowing it where Hatsumomo could find it. A shopkeeper who leaves his window open can hardly be angry at the rainstorm for ruining his wares. I went to the table to take the journal from Hatsumomo, but she clutched it to her chest and stood. In her other hand, she picked up the glass of what I'd thought was water. Now that I stood close to her, I could smell the odor of sake. It wasn't water at all. She was drunk. "Sayuri, of course you want your journal back, and of course I'm going to give it to you," she said, but she was walking toward the door as she said it. "The trouble is, I haven't finished reading it, so I'll take it back to my room, unless you'd rather I took it to Mother. I'm sure she'll be pleased to see the passages you've written about her." I mentioned earlier that a broken bottle of ointment lay on the floor of the hallway. This was how Hatsumomo did things, making a mess and not even bothering to tell the maids. But now, as she left my room, she got what she deserved. Probably she'd forgotten about the bottle because she was drunk. In any case, she stepped right into the broken glass and let out a little shriek. I saw her look at her foot a moment and make a gasping noise, but then she kept on going. I felt myself panicking as she stepped into her room. I thought of trying to wrestle the book from her hands, but then I remembered Mameha's realization at the sumo tournament. To rush after Hatsumomo was the obvious thing. I'd be better off to wait until she began to relax, thinking she'd won, and then take the journal from her when she wasn't expecting it. This seemed to me a fine idea, until a moment later, when I had an image of her hiding it in a place I might never find. By now, she'd closed the door. I went to stand outside it and called out quietly, "Hatsumomo-san, I'm sorry if I seemed angry. May I come in?"
"No, you may not," she said. I slid the door open anyway. The room was in terrible disarray because Hatsumomo had put things everywhere in her efforts at moving. The journal was sitting on the table while Hatsumomo held a towel against her foot. I had no idea how I would distract her, but I certainly didn't intend to leave the room without the journal. She may have had the personality of a water rat, but Hatsumomo was no fool. If she'd been sober, I wouldn't even have tried to outsmart her right then. But considering her state at the moment, I looked around the floor at the piles of underclothing, bottles of perfume, and all the other things she'd scattered in disarray. The closet door was open, and the tiny safe where she kept her jewelry stood ajar. Pieces were spilling out onto the mats, as though she'd sat there earlier in the morning drinking and trying them on. And then one object caught my eye as clearly as a single star burning in a black sky. It was an emerald obi brooch, the very one Hatsumomo had accused me of stealing years earlier on the night I'd found her and her boyfriend in the maid's room. I'd never expected to see it again. I walked directly to the closet and reached down to pluck it from among the jewelry lying there. "What a wonderful idea," Hatsumomo said. "Go ahead and steal a piece of my jewelry. Truthfully, I'd rather have the cash you'll have to pay me." "I'm so pleased you don't mind," I told her. "But how much cash will I have to pay for this?" As I said these words, I walked over and held the brooch up before her. The radiant smile she'd worn now faded, just as the darkness fades from a valley when the sun rises on it. In that moment, while Hatsumomo sat stunned, I simply reached down to the table with my other hand and took the journal away. I had no notion how Hatsumomo would react, but I walked out the door and closed it behind me. I thought of going straight to Mother to show her what I'd found, but of course I couldn't very well go there with the journal in my hand. As quickly as I could, I slid open the door to the closet where in-season kimono were kept and stashed the journal on a shelf between two robes wrapped in tissue paper. It took no more than a few seconds, but all the while my back tingled from the sensation that at any moment Hatsumomo might open her door and spot me. After I'd shut the door closed again, I rushed into my room and began opening and closing the drawers to my makeup stand to give Hatsumomo the impression I'd hid the journal there. When I came out into the hallway, she was watching me from the doorway of her room, wearing a little smile, as though she found the whole situation amusing. I tried to look worried, which wasn't too difficult, and carried the brooch with me into Mother's room to lay it on the table before her. She put aside the magazine she was reading and held it up to admire it. "This is a lovely piece," she said, "but it won't go far on the black market these days. No one pays much for jewels like this one." "I'm sure Hatsumomo will pay very dearly for it, Mother," I said. "Do you remember the brooch I'm supposed to have stolen from her years ago, the one that was added to my debts? That is it. I've just found it on the floor near her jewelry box." "Do you know," said Hatsumomo, who had come in the room and now stood behind me, "I believe Sayuri is right. That is the brooch I lost, or at least it looks like it. I never thought I'd see it again." "Yes, it's very difficult to find things when you're drunk all the time," I said. "If only you'd looked in your jewelry box more closely." Mother put the brooch down on the table and went on glowering at Hatsumomo. "I found it in her room," Hatsumomo said. "She'd hidden it in her makeup stand."
"Why were you looking through her makeup stand?" Mother said.
"I didn't want to tell you this, Mother, but Sayuri left something on her table, and I was trying to hide it for her. I know I should have brought it to you at once, but she was keeping a journal, you see. She showed it to me last year. She's written some very incriminating things about certain men, and truthfully, there are some passages about you too, Mother." I thought of insisting it wasn't true, but none of it mattered in any case. Hatsumomo was in trouble, and nothing she was going to say would change the situation. 10 years earlier, when she had been the Okia's principal earner, she probably could have accused me of anything she'd wanted. She could have claimed I'd eaten the tatami mats in her room, and Mother would have charged me the cost of new ones. But now, at last, the season had changed. Hatsumomo's brilliant career was dying on the branch, while mine had begun to blossom.
I was the daughter of the Okia and its prime geisha. I don't think Mother even cared where the truth lay.
There is no journal, Mother, I said. Hatsumomo is making it up.
Am I? Said Hatsumomo.
I'll just go and find it then, and while Mother reads through it, you can tell her how I made it up.
Hatsumomo went to my room, with Mother following. The hallway floor was a terrible mess. Not only had Hatsumomo broken a bottle and then stepped on it, she'd tracked ointment and blood all around the upstairs hall, and much worse, onto the tatami mats in her own room, Mother's room, and now mine as well. She was kneeling at my dressing table when I looked in, closing the drawers very slowly and looking a bit defeated.
"What journal is Hatsumomo talking about?" Mother asked me.
"If there's a journal, I'm certain Hatsumomo will find it," I said.
At this, Hatsumomo put her hands into her lap and gave a little laugh, as though the whole thing had been some sort of game and she'd been cleverly outwitted.
"Hatsumomo," Mother said to her, "you'll repay Sayori for the brooch you accused her of stealing. What's more, I won't have the tatami in this Okia defiled with blood. They'll be replaced, and at your expense. This has been a very costly day for you, and it's hardly past noon. Shall I hold off calculating the total, just in case you're not quite finished?"
I don't know if Hatsumomo heard what Mother said. She was too busy glaring at me, and with a look on her face I wasn't accustomed to seeing. If you'd asked me, while I was still a young woman, to tell you the turning point in my relationship with Hatsumomo, I would have said it was my Mizwage. But even though it's quite true that my Mizwage lifted me onto a high shelf where Hatsumomo could no longer reach me, she and I might well have gone on living side by side until we were old women, if nothing else had happened between us. This is why the real turning point, as I've since come to see it, occurred the day when Hatsumomo read my journal and I discovered the obi brooch she'd accused me of stealing. By way of explaining why this is so, let me tell you something Admiral Yamamoto Izuroku once said during an evening at the Ichiriki Tea House. I can't pretend I was well acquainted with Admiral Yamamoto, who's usually described as the father of the Japanese Imperial Navy, but I was privileged to attend parties with him on a number of occasions. He was a small man, but keep in mind that a stick of dynamite is small, too. Parties always grew noisier after the admiral arrived. That night, he and another man were in the final round of a drinking game and had agreed that the loser would go to buy a condom at the nearest pharmacy, just for the embarrassment of it, you understand, not for any other purpose. Of course, the admiral ended up winning, and the whole crowd broke into cheers and applause.
"It's a good thing you didn't lose, Admiral," said one of his aides. "Think of the poor pharmacist looking up to find Admiral Yamamoto Izuroku on the other side of the counter."
Everyone thought this was very funny, but the admiral replied that he'd never had any doubt about winning.
"Oh, come now," said one of the geisha. "Everyone loses from time to time, even you, admiral."
"I suppose it's true that everyone loses at some time," he said, "but never me."
Some in the room may have considered this an arrogant thing to say, but I wasn't one of them. The admiral seemed to me the sort of man who really was accustomed to winning. Finally, someone asked him the secret of his success.
"I never seek to defeat the man I am fighting," he explained. "I seek to defeat his confidence. A mind troubled by doubt cannot focus on the course of victory. Two men are equals, true equals, only when they both have equal confidence."
I don't think I realized it at the time, but after Hatsumomo and I quarreled over my journal, her mind, as the admiral would have put it, began to be troubled by doubt. She knew that under no circumstances would Mother take her side against me any longer, and because of that, she was like a fabric taken from its warm closet and hung out of doors where the harsh weather will gradually consume it. If Mameha were to hear me explaining things in this way, she would certainly speak up and say how much she disagreed. Her view of Hatsumomo was quite different from mine. She believed Hatsumomo was a woman bent on self-destruction, and that all we needed to do was to coax her along a path she was certain to follow in any case. Perhaps Mameha was right, I don't know. It's true that in the years since my Mizwage, Hatsumomo had gradually been afflicted by some sort of disease of the character, if such a thing exists, She'd lost all control over her drinking, for example, and of her bouts of cruelty, too. Until her life began to fray, she'd always used her cruelty for a purpose, just as a samurai draws his sword, not for slashing at random, but for slashing at enemies. But by this time in her life, Hatsumomo seemed to have lost sight of who her enemies were, and sometimes struck out even at Pumpkin. From time to time during parties, she even made insulting comments to the men she was entertaining. And another thing, she was no longer as beautiful as she'd once been. Her skin was waxy-looking, and her features puffy. Or perhaps I was only seeing her that way. A tree may look as beautiful as ever, but when you notice the insects infesting it and the tips of the branches that are brown from disease, even the trunk seems to lose some of its magnificence. Everyone knows that a wounded tiger is a dangerous beast, and for this reason, Mameha insisted that we follow Hatsumomo around Gion during the evenings over the next few weeks. Partly, Mameha wanted to keep an eye on her, because neither of us would have been surprised if she'd sought out Nobu to tell him about the contents of my journal and about all my secret feelings for Mr. Ha, whom Nobu might have recognized as the chairman. But more important, Mameha wanted to make Hatsumomo's life difficult for her to bear. "When you want to break a board," Mameha said, "cracking it in the middle is only the first step. Success comes when you bounce up and down with all your weight until the board snaps in half." So every evening, except when she had an engagement she couldn't miss, Mameha came to our okia around dusk and waited to walk out the door behind Hatsumomo. Mameha and I weren't always able to stay together, but usually at least one of us managed to follow her from engagement to engagement for a portion of the evening. On the first night we did this, Hatsumomo pretended to find it amusing, but by the end of the fourth night, she was looking at us through squinted, angry eyes and had difficulty acting cheerful around the men she tried to entertain. Then, early the following week, she suddenly wheeled around in an alleyway and came toward us. "Let me see now," she said. "Dogs follow their owners, and the two of you are following me around, sniffing and sniffing. So I guess you want to be treated like dogs. Shall I show you what I do with dogs I don't like?" And with this, she drew back her hand to strike Mameha on the side of the head. I screamed, which must have made Hatsumomo stop to think about what she was doing. She stared at me a moment with eyes burning before the fire went out of them, and she walked away. Everyone in the alley had noticed what was happening, and a few came over to see if Mameha was all right. She assured them she was fine and then said sadly, "Poor Hatsumomo! It must be just as the doctor said. She really does seem to be losing her mind." There was no doctor, of course, but Mameha's words had the effect she'd hoped for. Soon, a rumor had spread all over Gion that a doctor had declared Hatsumomo mentally unstable. For years, Hatsumomo had been very close to the famous kabuki actor Bando Shojiro VI. Shojiro was what we call an onagata, which means that he always played women's roles. Once, in a magazine interview, he said that Hatsumomo was the most beautiful woman he'd ever seen, and that on the stage he often imitated her gestures to make himself seem more alluring. So you can well imagine that whenever Shojiro was in town, Hatsumomo visited him. One afternoon, I learned that Shojiro would attend a party later that evening at a tea house in the geisha district of Pontocho, on the other side of the river from Gion. I heard this bit of news while preparing a tea ceremony for a group of naval officers on leave. Afterward, I rushed back to the okia, but Hatsumomo had already dressed and snuck out. She was doing what I'd once done, leaving early so that no one would follow her. I was very eager to explain to Mameha what I'd learned, so I went straight to her apartment. Unfortunately, her maid told me she'd left a half hour earlier to worship. I knew exactly what this meant. Mameha had gone to a little temple just at the eastern edge of Gion to pray before the three tiny Jizo statues she'd paid to have erected there. A Jizo, you see, honors the soul of a departed child. In Mameha's case, they were for the three children she'd aborted at the Baron's request. Under other circumstances, I might have gone searching for her, but I couldn't possibly disturb her in such a private moment, and besides, she might not have wanted me to know even that she'd gone there. Instead, I sat in her apartment and permitted Tatsumi to serve me tea while I waited. At last, with something of a weary look about her, Mameha came home. I didn't want to raise the subject at first, and so for a time we chatted about the upcoming Festival of the Ages, in which Mameha was scheduled to portray Lady Murasaki Shikibu, author of The Tale of Genji. Finally, Mameha looked up with a smile from her cup of brown tea. Tatsumi had been roasting the leaves when I arrived, and I told her what I'd discovered during the course of the afternoon.
"How perfect," she said. "Hatsumoma's going to relax and think she's free of us. With all the attention Shojiro is certain to give her at the party, she may feel renewed. Then you and I will come drifting in like some sort of horrid smell from the alleyway and ruin her evening completely." Considering how cruelly Hatsumomo had treated me over the years, and how very much I hated her, I'm sure I ought to have been elated at this plan, but somehow, conspiring to make Hatsumomo suffer wasn't the pleasure I might have imagined. I couldn't help remembering one morning as a child, when I was swimming in the pond near our tipsy house, and suddenly felt a terrible burning in my shoulder. A wasp had stung me, and was struggling to free itself from my skin. I was too busy screaming to think of what to do, but one of the boys pulled the wasp off and held it by the wings upon a rock, where we all gathered to decide exactly how to murder it. I was in great pain because of the wasp, and certainly felt no kindness toward it, but it gave me a terrible sensation of weakness in my chest to know that this tiny struggling creature could do nothing to save itself from the death that was only moments away. I felt the same sort of pity toward Hatsumomo. During evenings when we trailed her around Gion until she returned to the Okia just to get away from us, I felt almost as though we were torturing her. In any case, around 9 o'clock that night, we crossed the river to the Pontocho district. Unlike Gion, which sprawls over many blocks, Pontocho is just a single long alleyway stretched out along one bank of the river. People call it an eel's bed because of its shape. The autumn air was a bit chilly that night, but Shojiro's party was outdoors anyway, on a wooden veranda standing on stilts above the water. No one paid us much attention when we stepped out through the glass doors. The veranda was beautifully lit with paper lanterns, and the river shimmered gold from the lights of a restaurant on the opposite bank. Everyone was listening to Shojiro, who was in the middle of telling a story in his sing-song voice, but you should have seen the way Hatsumoma's expression soured when she caught sight of us. I couldn't help remembering a damaged pear I'd held in my hand the day before, because amid the cheerful faces, Hatsumomo's expression was like a terrible bruise. Mameha went to kneel on a mat right beside Hatsumomo, which I considered very bold of her. I knelt toward the other end of the veranda, beside a gentle-looking old man who turned out to be the koto player Tachibana Zensaku, whose scratchy old records I still own. Tachibana was blind, I discovered that night. Regardless of my purpose in coming, I would have been content to spend the evening just chatting with him, for he was such a fascinating, endearing man. But we'd hardly begun to talk when suddenly everyone burst out laughing. Shojiro was quite a remarkable mimic. He was slender like the branch of a willow, with elegant, slow-moving fingers, and a very long face he could move about in extraordinary ways. He could have fooled a group of monkeys into thinking he was one of them. At that moment he was imitating a geisha beside him, a woman in her 50s. With his effeminate gestures, his pursed lips, his rolls of the eyes, he managed to look so much like her that I didn't know whether to laugh or just sit with my hand over my mouth in astonishment. I'd seen Shojiro on the stage, but this was something much better. Tachibana leaned in toward me and whispered, "What is he doing?" "He's imitating an older geisha beside him." "Ah," said Tachibana, "that would be Ichiwari." And then he tapped me with the back of his hand to make sure he had my attention. "The director of the Minamisa Theater," he said, and held out his little finger below the table where no one else could see it. In Japan, you see, holding up the little finger means boyfriend or girlfriend. Tachibana was telling me that the older geisha, the one named Ichiwari, was the theater director's mistress, and in fact, the director was there too, laughing louder than anyone. A moment later, still in the midst of his mimicry, Shojiro stuck one of his fingers up his nose. At this, everyone let out a laugh so loud you could feel the veranda trembling. I didn't know it at the time, but picking her nose was one of Ichiwari's well-known habits. She turned bright red when she saw this, and held the sleeve of her kimono over her face, and Shojiro, who had drunk a good bit of sake, imitated her even then. People laughed politely, but only Hatsumomo seemed to find it really funny, for at this point, Shojiro was beginning to cross the line into cruelty. Finally, the theater director said, "Now, now, Shojiro-san, save some energy for your show tomorrow. Anyway, don't you know you're sitting near one of Gion's greatest dancers? I propose that we ask for a performance." Of course, the director was talking about Mameha. "Heavens no, I don't want to see any dancing just now," Shojiro said. As I came to understand over the years, he preferred to be the center of attention himself. "Besides, I'm having fun."
"Shojiro-san, we mustn't pass up an opportunity to see the famous Mameha," the director said, speaking this time without a trace of humor.
A few geisha spoke up as well, and finally Shojiro was persuaded to ask her if she would perform, which he did as sulkily as a little boy. Already I could see Hatsumomo looking displeased. She poured more sake for Shojiro, and he poured more for her. They exchanged a long look, as if to say their party had been spoiled. A few minutes passed while a maid was sent to fetch a shamisen, and one of the geisha tuned it and prepared to play. Then Mameha took her place against the backdrop of the tea house and performed a few very short pieces. Nearly anyone would have agreed that Mameha was a lovely woman, but very few people would have found her more beautiful than Hatsumomo, so I can't say exactly what caught Shojiro's eye. It may have been the sake he'd drunk, or it may have been Mameha's extraordinary dancing, for Shojiro was a dancer himself. Whatever it was, by the time Mameha came back to join us at the table, Shojiro seemed quite taken with her and asked that she sit beside him. When she did, he poured her a cup of sake and turned his back on Hatsumomo as if she were just another adoring apprentice. Well, Hatsumomo's mouth hardened and her eyes shrank to about half their size. As for Mameha, I never saw her flirt with anyone more deliberately than she did with Shojiro. Her face grew high and soft, and her eyes swished from his chest to his face and back again. From time to time she drew the fingertips of her hand across the base of her throat, as though she felt self-conscious about the splotchy blush that had appeared there. There wasn't really any blush, but she acted it so convincingly you wouldn't have known it without looking closely. Then one of the geisha asked Shojiro if he'd heard from Baijiru-san. "Baijiru-san," said Shojiro in his most dramatic manner, "has abandoned me." I had no idea who Shojiro was talking about, but Tachibana, the old koto player, was kind enough to explain in a whisper that Baijiru-san was the English actor Basil Rathbone, though I'd never heard of him at the time. Shojiro had taken a trip to London a few years earlier and staged a kabuki performance there. The actor, Basil Rathbone, had admired it so much that with the help of an interpreter, the two of them had developed something of a friendship. Shojiro may have lavished attention on women like Hatsumomo or Mameha, but the fact remained that he was homosexual, and since his trip to England, he'd made it a running joke that his heart was destined to be broken because Bajiru-san had no interest in men.
"It makes me sad," said one of the geisha quietly, "to witness the death of a romance."
Everyone laughed except for Hatsumomo, who went on glowering at Shojiro.
"The difference between me and Bajiru-san is this. I'll show you," Shojiro said, and with this he stood and asked Mameha to join him. He led her off to one side of the room, where they had a bit of space. "When I do my work, I look like this," he said, and he sashayed from one side of the room to the other, waving his folding fan with a most fluid wrist, and letting his head roll back and forth like a ball on a seesaw. "Whereas, when Bajura-san does his work, he looks like this." Here he grabbed Mameha, and you should have seen the astonished expression on her face when he dipped her toward the floor in what looked like a passionate embrace and planted kisses all over her face. Everyone in the room cheered and clapped, everyone except Hatsumomo, that is.
"What is he doing?" Tachibana asked me quietly.
I didn't think anyone else had heard, but before I could reply, Hatsumomo cried out,
He's making a fool of himself, that's what he's doing.
Oh, Hatsumomo-san, said Shojiro, you're jealous, aren't you?
Of course she is, said Mameha. Now you must show us how the two of you make up. Go on, Shojiro-san, don't be shy. You must give her the very same kisses you gave to me. It's only fair, and in the same way.
Shojiro didn't have an easy time of it, but soon he succeeded in getting Hatsumomo to her feet. Then, with the crowd behind him, he took her in his arms and bent her back. But after only an instant, he jerked upright again with a shout and grabbed his lip. Hatsumomo had bitten him, not enough to make him bleed, but certainly enough to give him a shock. She was standing with her eyes squinted in anger and her teeth exposed, and then she drew back her hand and slapped him. I think her aim must have been bad from all the sake she'd drunk, because she hit the side of his head rather than his face.
What happened? Tachibana asked me.
His words were as clear in the quiet of the room as if someone had rung a bell. I didn't answer, but when he heard Shojiro's whimper and the heavy breathing of Hatsumomo, I'm sure he understood.
Hatsumomo-san, please, said Mameha, speaking in a voice so calm it sounded completely out of place. As a favor to me, do try to calm down. I don't know if Mameha's words had the precise effect she was hoping for, or whether Hatsumomo's mind had already shattered. But Hatsumomo threw herself at Shojiro and began hitting him everywhere. I do think that, in a way, she went crazy. It wasn't just that her mind seemed to have fractured. The moment itself seemed disconnected from everything else. The theater director got up from the table and rushed over to restrain her. Somehow, in the middle of all this, Mameha slipped out and returned a moment later with the mistress of the tea house. By that time, the theater director was holding Hatsumomo from behind. I thought the crisis was over, but then Shojiro shouted at Hatsumomo so loudly we heard it echo off the buildings across the river in Gion.
"You monster!" he screamed. "You've bitten me!"
I don't know what any of us would have done without the calm thinking of the mistress. She spoke to Shojiro in a soothing voice while at the same time giving the theater director a signal to take Hatsumomo away. As I later learned, he didn't just take her inside the tea house. He took her downstairs to the front and shoved her out onto the street. Hatsumomo didn't return to the Okia at all that night. When she did come back the following day, she smelled as if she had been sick to her stomach, and her hair was in disarray. She was summoned at once to Mother's room and spent a long while there. A few days afterward, Hatsumomo left the Okia, wearing a simple cotton robe Mother had given her, and with her hair, as I'd never seen it, hanging in a mass around her shoulders. She carried a bag containing her belongings and jewelry, and didn't say goodbye to any of us, but just walked out to the street. She didn't leave voluntarily. Mother had thrown her out. And in fact, Mameha believed Mother had probably been trying to get rid of Hatsumomo for years. Whether or not this is true, I'm sure Mother was pleased at having fewer mouths to feed, since Hatsumomo was no longer earning what she once had, and food had never been more difficult to come by. If Hatsumomo hadn't been renowned for her wickedness, some other Okia might have wanted her even after what she'd done to Shojiro, but she was like a tea kettle that even on a good day might still scald the hand of anyone who used it. Everyone in Gion understood this about her. I don't know for sure whatever became of Hatsumomo. A few years after the war, I heard she was making a living as a prostitute in the Miyagawa-cho district. She couldn't have been there long, because on the night I heard it, a man at the same party swore that if Hatsumomo was a prostitute, he would find her and give her some business of his own. He did go looking for her, but she was nowhere to be found. Over the years, she probably succeeded in drinking herself to death. She certainly wouldn't have been the first geisha to do it. In just the way that a man can grow accustomed to a bad leg, we'd all grown accustomed to having Hatsumomo in our okia. I don't think we quite understood all the ways her presence had afflicted us until long after she'd left, when things we hadn't realized were ailing slowly began to heal. Even when Hatsumomo had been doing nothing more than sleeping in her room, the maids had known she was there and that during the course of the day she would abuse them. They'd lived with the kind of tension you feel if you walk across a frozen pond whose ice might break at any moment. As for Pumpkin, I think she'd grown to be dependent on her older sister,
and felt strangely lost without her. I'd already become the Oki's principal asset, but even I took some time to weed out all the peculiar habits that had taken root because of Hatsumomo. Every time a man looked at me strangely, I found myself wondering if he'd heard something unkind about me from her, even long after she was gone. Whenever I climbed the stairs to the second floor of the Okia, I still kept my eyes lowered for fear that Hatsumomo would be waiting there on the landing, eager for someone to abuse. I can't tell you how many times I reached that last step and looked up suddenly with the realization that there was no Hatsumomo and there never would be again. I knew she was gone, and yet the very emptiness of the hall seemed to suggest something of her presence. Even now, as an older woman, I sometimes lift the brocade cover on the mirror of my makeup stand and have the briefest flicker of a thought that I may find her there in the glass smirking at me. Chapter 28. In Japan, we refer to the years from the Depression through World War II as Kurotani, the Valley of Darkness, when so many people lived like children whose heads had slipped beneath the waves. As is often the case, those of us in Gion didn't suffer quite as badly as others. While most Japanese lived in the dark valley all through the 1930s, for example, in Gion we were still warmed by a bit of sun. And I'm sure I don't need to tell you why. Women who are mistresses of cabinet ministers and naval commanders are the recipients of enormous good fortune, and they pass that good fortune along to others. You might say Gion was like a pond high up on a mountaintop, fed by streams of rich spring water. More water poured in at some spots than others, but it raised the pond as a whole. Because of General Tottori, our Okia was one of the spots where the rich spring water came pouring in. Things grew worse and worse around us during the course of several years, and yet, long after the rationing of goods had begun, we continued to receive regular supplies of foodstuffs, tea, linens, and even some luxuries like cosmetics and chocolate. We might have kept these things to ourselves and lived behind closed doors, but Gion isn't that sort of place. Mother passed much of it along and considered it well spent. Not because she is a generous woman, of course, but because we were all like spiders crowded together on the same web. From time to time, people came asking for help, and we were pleased to give it when we could. At some point in the fall of 1941, for example, the military police found a maid with a box containing probably 10 times more ration coupons than her Okia was supposed to have. Her mistress sent her to us for safekeeping until arrangements could be made to take her to the countryside. Because, of course, every Okia in Gion hoarded coupons. The better the Okia, the more it usually had. The maid was sent to us rather than to someone else because General Tottori had instructed the military police to leave us alone. So you see, even within that mountaintop pond that was Gion, we were the fish swimming in the very warmest water of all. As the darkness continued to settle over Japan, there did finally come a time when even the pinpoint of light in which we'd managed to keep ourselves suddenly went out. It happened at a single moment, early one afternoon, just a few weeks before New Year's Day in December 1942. I was eating my breakfast, or at least my first meal of the day, for I'd been busy helping to clean the Okia in preparation for the new year, when a man's voice called out at our entrance. I thought he was probably just making a delivery, so I went on with my meal. But a moment later, the maid interrupted me to say a military policeman had come looking for Mother. "A military policeman?" I said. "Tell him Mother is out." "Yes, I did, ma'am. He'd like to speak with you instead." When I reached the front hall, I found the policeman removing his boots in the entryway. Probably most people would have felt relieved just to note that his pistol was still snapped inside its leather case. But as I say, our Okia had lived differently right up until that moment. Ordinarily, a policeman would have been more apologetic even than most visitors, since his presence would alarm us. But to see him tugging at his boots, well, this was his way of saying he planned to come in whether we invited him or not. I bowed and greeted him, but he did nothing more than glance at me as though he would deal with me later. Finally, he pulled up his socks and pulled down his cap, and then stepped up into the front entrance hall and said he wanted to see our vegetable garden. Just like that, with no word of apology for troubling us. You see, by this time, nearly everyone in Kyoto, and probably the rest of the country, had converted their decorative gardens into vegetable gardens. Everyone but people like us, that is.